You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, May 18th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a tech day for us here, so we're not technically live. But we do have two interviews that I recorded for this past weekend's Ring of Fire. So if you missed it, you'll enjoy it. And if you did hear it, you'll enjoy them again. One is with Dean Baker, co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, on the TPP. Dean Baker does a lot of work, particularly in the patent field, so-called intellectual property in terms of how it relates to drugs. But we also discuss the issue of currency manipulation and our trade deficit and the strength of the dollar. And then following Dean Baker, an interview with Yale professor Jacob Hacker, who co-wrote a piece with Professor Paul Pearson on just how little the Republicans have suffered on because of their extremism. And in fact, contrary to what the punditry will tell you, they've actually gained. Despite the Christine O'Donnells, I'm not a witch, and they lose that Senate seat, broadly speaking, the Republicans have gained much from their extremism. So we have those two interviews for you. We will be back live tomorrow. Just a reminder, this show relies on your support. You can support us at majority.fm. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. And also, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com. So first up, Dean Baker. There's a little break in the middle, and then we come back. Dean Baker, of course, an economist, to talk about trade deficit, the weak dollar, and the sort of the regulatory structure of the TPP. Very important stuff relative to what's going on, obviously, as the president is seeking fast-track authority. And then we'll take a break and come back with Jacob Hacker. We'll be right back after, well, here's that interview now with Dean Baker.
My girl, I spent well. I had to be strong for my
Welcome back to Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar. In recent months, the value of the U.S. dollar has dramatically increased in overseas markets. This may sound like a good thing, but it's actually devastating to American manufacturers, as it makes American-made goods far more expensive overseas. This is just a snapshot of what could happen to the value of U.S. currency and goods if the proposed TPP partnership becomes a reality. And I have economist Dean Baker with me now to explain why that is. So, Dean, let's start. I mean, this week we saw the TPA, which is the fast-track authority, essentially, fail to gain enough votes to actually close debate on it in the Senate. It remains to be seen whether or not that's going to be able to move forward in the Senate. Everyone seems to be predicting that eventually a deal will be struck, and then the real problems will be in the House. But let's talk about where the underlying controversy really lies, not so much in the fast-track authority per se, but in the TTP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and its cousin deal with Europe, the TTIP. There's a couple of elements in those deals that people have a problem with that you specifically have written quite a bit about. But let's talk about one of the laws that Harry Reid was insisting be part of the package that would have been involved in the TPA, and that has to deal with currency manipulation. Talk to us about what the implications are of currency manipulation by other countries and a largely speaking, a strong dollar here.
The point is we have a large trade deficit. It's over $500 billion. In fact, the recent month it was close to $600 billion. And this is money that's being drained directly from the U.S. economy. This is important in the context of us being below full employment. We don't have enough demand in the economy. We need more demand. This has been true ever since the housing bubble burst. We lost all the demand that was being created by the bubble. It's partly offset by the stimulus back in 2009, 2010. That's long gone. That's long over. So we don't have a source of demand to replace this $500 billion that's going to other countries, creating demand there rather than here. It's the same thing as if workers took $500 billion out of their paychecks every year and stuffed it under their mattress instead of spending it. So the question is, how do you do something about that? How do you address the trade deficit? Well, the way you address it is you get the value of the dollar down. A lower value dollar, a more competitive dollar, makes our exports cheaper to other countries, so they'll buy more. They'd buy more of our goods in Europe, Japan, China, wherever it might be. And also it has the effect of making imports more expensive in the United States, which means we're more likely to buy the U.S.-made car, the U.S.-made refrigerator, whatever it might be, rather than goods that are produced in other countries. So that's a way of increasing demand in the U.S. economy, getting us back towards full employment. And I should add, if we're not back towards full employment, workers are not going to have enough bargaining power to get their share of economic growth. So this is really important. It's not just kind of a sidebar like, oh, wouldn't it be nice to have a little lower trade deficit? We don't have a way. No one can stand up with a straight face and tell you we have a way to get back to full employment that doesn't involve getting the trade deficit down.
Where has our trade deficit traditionally been? I mean, in other words, when we've talked about being closer to full employment or at full employment, where was our trade deficit at that point?
Well, we had modest trade deficits through most of the 80s and 90s. I won't go through all the details there, but up till the mid-90s, late 90s, our trade deficit was about 1% of GDP. That'd be around $180 billion a year in today's economy. Exploded in the late 90s following the East Asian financial crisis. Basic story was the dollar soared in value against other currencies, and that made our goods uncompetitive. So it went from 1% of GDP, or a little over in 96, to about 4% of GDP by 2000. Now, we still had full employment in 2000, but that was because we had a stock bubble. That bubble burst, and that gave us the recession in 2001, 2002. We didn't get back till something near full employment. We could argue whether it was full employment, something near full employment until 2006, 2007, but that was on the back of the housing bubble. So the way we've been able to overcome the demand drain from the trade deficit has been in the 90s, late 90s and 2000 with the stock bubble. In the last decade, it was with the housing bubble. So if someone wants to tell me, oh, we'll just have another bubble, well, yeah, sure, that will do it, but you know, we want to go through this again? I mean, so that's the story. I mean, again, there's another way we could do it. We could have the government spend lots of money, and, you know, I think that'd be a good thing. You know, we could build up our infrastructure. We could deal with, you know, improve health care, child care. We could do that. But politically, that's not going to happen. So we don't have a way to get back to full employment unless we address the trade deficit.
Are there specific, I guess, interests that are helped by a strong dollar? I mean, obviously, if I take a trip to Europe this summer, I'm going to appreciate a strong dollar. But that doesn't, an economy is not necessarily built on the fact that I can take a trip and, you know, maybe get a nicer meal than I would have otherwise. But are there interests? Are there industry interests? Are there
absolutely. Yeah, and that's really fundamental here, because sometimes this is put as, you know, oh, we're fighting China, we're fighting Korea, you know, it's us against, you know, these countries, and they won't agree to it, this and that. And, you know, yeah, there's issues. Obviously, people in those countries benefit. But the bottom line in this case is that we have powerful interests in the United States that benefit from the high dollar. And first and foremost, we have a lot of importers. I'll put Walmart front and center. They've made a big effort in the last two decades to set up low-cost supply chains in China and other developing countries. Last thing on earth they want to see is everything they import from China costs 20% more because the dollar falls against the Chinese yuan. So you have retailers like that. Many of our big manufacturers, General Electric, produces more of their goods overseas than they do in the United States. There too, you know, they're not anxious to see the dollar fall against these other currencies, and all those items they're now producing in China or Mexico, wherever it might be, cost, you know, 10, 15, 20% more. The financial industry tends to prefer a strong dollar. Actually, the example you gave, it's cheaper for you to go overseas. I wouldn't poo-poo that, because a lot of the people who effectively make decisions in Congress are congressional staffers, and many of them take vacations overseas. That might sound silly, but, you know, you go. I've talked with them, and, you know, you go, look, we need a lower value dollar, blah, 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 blah. And they're thinking, and I've had some of them say that, so, you know, my trip to France is going to cost me more this summer. So that actually, I mean, that's not the most important factor, but, you know, that does play in.
I will say that's the most disturbing factor on some level. But all right, so what of those people who, and we heard this quite a bit, more so a couple of years ago, but what about those who say that it is apocalyptic if our dollar drops too much in value to the rest of the world? I mean, we hear people, is the implication that they're suggesting is that if our dollar drops too much in value, then people will not, foreign entities will not loan us money by buying bonds, and therefore we will will default or something. I mean, what is the concern with the dollar dropping in value?
Well, I think it's very hard to imagine realistic concern. First off, we don't have to worry about default because our debt, with maybe some tiny exceptions, is almost all in dollars. So,
right.
You know, if the dollar were to fall, you know, 70, 80, 90%, you lent us dollars, the contract says you get dollars, you know, that's the way it goes. Maybe they wouldn't be, you know, whoever lent it to us, you know, foreign investors at least may not be happy, but that was the contract. So that really wouldn't be a concern. Now, could the dollar go into some sort of free fall? Well, in principle, anything could happen, but, you know, basically, if we had a healthy economy and let's say the dollar fell, you know, I'm saying 15-20%, you know, somewhere as a ballpark number as to the depreciation of the dollar we might need to get back to something close to balanced trade. I mean, it doesn't have to be balanced, but, you know, something, you know, closer that will allow us to get to full employment. Let's say it fell more than that. Let's say it fell 30%, 35%. Well, suddenly our goods and services are hyper-competitive. And I would expect, I mean, you know, Japan, China, Europe, they would be hurting themselves to let the dollar keep falling like that. So the idea we'd have to worry about a free fall, again, as long as we have a healthy economy. If the economy were to go to pieces and we no longer produce anything that anyone in the world wants, which, you know, as much problem as we might have in our economy, that's not where we are. But, you know, as long as we have a healthy economy, other countries would stand more to lose from a dollar that just fell through the floor than us.
All right, Dean Baker, let's take a break. We've just explained why there would be interest from Senate Democrats to have, and others, I should say, to have some mechanism to make sure that other countries are not manipulating their currencies to make their currency weaker against the dollar. When we come back, let's talk about the other problems with, more broadly speaking, with the TPP. And that has to do with whether or not this is actually a trade deal or really just a way to codify regulations that help certain industries across the world and, I guess, in perpetuity. We're going to take a brief break. We'll be right back with Dean Baker after this. We're back on Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking with Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Studies, about the problems that come along with having a high-value dollar in overseas markets, and also some of the hidden dangers of the TPP. So, Dean, before the break, you were explaining to us the how our strong dollar, while it's maybe making for more luxurious trips for congressional staffers who are going to Europe this summer, or anybody who's going to Europe this summer, for that matter, at least who's traveling with dollars, maybe making it a little bit more pleasant. But it's hurting manufacturing in this country, and it's keeping us from getting to full employment. And that was the basis for why some senators, at least, insisted upon currency manipulation stipulations in approving fast-track authority for the president for any future trade deals. Let's talk about the TPP, more specifically, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. One of the things that I know that you have been writing about for years now, and obviously not just in the context of this trade deal, are things like copyright and patent laws. What does that got to do with the TPP?
Well, this is often touted as this huge trade deal, and it's really misleading in two ways. First off, most of the countries that they say, you know, they come up with a figure 40% of the world economies include the TPP. Well, the vast majority of that's already in trade deals with the United States. So Mexico's in the TPP, they're in NAFTA. Canada's in the TPP, they're in NAFTA. Australia's in the TPP, we already have a trade deal with Australia. Most of the countries, 6 of the 11 countries other than the U.S., and the bigger ones, with the exception of Japan, already have trade deals with the U.S. So their trade terms will be little affected by the TPP. The other point is that even the other 5 countries, in most cases our trade barriers, our tariffs, their tariffs, they're for the most part already relatively low. You wouldn't have the big scene over we're going to eliminate a 1.5% tariff. That's the average tariff that Japan has on U.S. goods. We wouldn't make a big scene over that. You know, it's not going to be that big a deal. So most of this story isn't about trade. It's about regulations, a whole set of business regulations. They're going to try to standardize regulations across countries. Some of that might be fine. Some of that might be problematic. We'd probably think that should be decided in, you know, some more democratic process, but standardization isn't necessarily bad. A lot of good things you could say about it. But the point is, it's being decided by business lobbyists. And the one area that, you know, particularly concerns me, actually many areas, but the one that really concerns me is not trade, free trade at all. It's the opposite. They're talking about increasing patent and copyright protections. And this is especially a big deal with prescription drugs because their proposals are likely to increase the price of prescription drugs, certainly for other countries. But in many cases, they're likely to increase the price of drugs in the United States as well. And it's important to understand what's going on here because drugs are, you know, almost all cases cheap to produce. You know, you get generic drugs at, you know, a chain drugstore for $5 or $10 a prescription. They're making profits on that. They're not giving them away. The drugs that you might pay hundreds or even thousands of dollars for, they're not expensive because they're hard to produce. They're expensive because we have patent monopolies. So you have a company that has a patent on a drug, and they'll have anyone else arrested if they try to sell that drug. So what we're trying to do in the Trans-Pacific Partnership is extend and strengthen those patent monopolies, primarily in other countries, but also in ways that will affect the United States as well. So that really concerns me. This isn't free trade. It's the exact opposite. It's protectionism.
And not only that, it seems to me, the mechanism for which this gets standardized, there is no mechanism, it seems, that at least can happen from any given country. And I don't know if there's a mechanism at all. This, like, once we get these regulations in, these are basically... these are then sort of cast in amber, aren't they? I mean, so we don't have the ability of over time to understand issues differently and change policy here.
That's right. There's two points to be made about this. First off, the trade agreement basically overrides domestic law. So if we pass this trade agreement, we're bound by it. I mean, we could, you know, there are ways you could get out of them, but they're not very easy. My knowledge, we've never gotten out of a trade agreement. So once it's there, we should anticipate it's going to be there a long, long time. The other point is the enforcement mechanism. And this is, again, one of these bizarre things. When I first heard about this, someone told me, I thought they didn't know what they're talking about. I looked it up, and they were right. we have a system of investor-state dispute settlement tribunals. That's in other agreements, and that would be in this. And the way those are set up, these are totally outside our judiciary system. They have three people on a panel. One's appointed by the investor, so an investor's taking action against the United States, say. One's appointed by the administration. They'll appoint a person to presumably present our position, and they jointly agree on a third person. They'll make a ruling. They're not bound by prior precedents. It's not subject to appeal, and, in fact, it's even held secret for, I believe it's 5 years. I guess we'll find the exact time when the deal is shown publicly. But this is a very, very strange process. On the one hand, it's totally asymmetric in the sense that we can't sue, people in the United States can't sue a foreign investor, and for that matter, the country itself can't sue a foreign investor. Secondly, you know, again, there's no issue, there's no appeal, they aren't bound by precedent. You have this tribunal, and you might say, hey, another tribunal said the opposite, and they go, that's nice, we don't agree. You know, we're doing, you know, it's not the sort of legal system that, in the United States at least, we're used to.
This you're talking about such an almost unprecedented level of unaccountability, right? I mean, it's done in secret. It's not bound by precedent. There's nothing that really it can be held accountable to. And we should say that patients and consumers and workers certainly have no part of this process. They can't bring an action. They can't sit in judgment of an action. Nothing.
That's right, and important to understand because you get into this semantic issue where defenders of this process say, well, they can't overturn laws. No, they can't literally overturn a law. So let's say that the state of New York bans fracking, as it has, and let's say that a foreign investor said, hey, I bought all this land, I wanted to frack on it, and that's a violation of the treaty. So then you have this tribunal, and they go, yeah, it's a violation of the treaty. State of New York's going to have to pay $100 million a year to this foreign investor if they don't allow them to frack. Well, they haven't overturned the law. New York's, you know, sure, you can keep your no fracking law. You're just going to have to pay $100 million a year to this company to keep it. So that's where you get this absurd semantics. No, they don't literally overturn the law. They just say you're going to have to pay a lot of money to keep it. And to take that a step further, you know, President Obama is saying, you know, I would never, you know, let this be used against financial regulation. I'd never let it be used to harm the environment, et cetera, et cetera. Let's grant him his word on that. That may well be true. But he's leaving the White House in January 2017. We don't know who's coming in. So let's hypothesize you have a Scott Walker, Jeb Bush, whoever it might be, who thinks fracking's great. So you get a foreign investor, goes to the state of New York, gets a pile of land, says, hey, I want to frack. New York, state of New York says, no, we don't allow fracking. So they go to this dispute settlement mechanism. They appoint their person. Bush or Walker administration appoints their person. They jointly agree on a third person. What direction do you think it's going to go in?
And let me just add, as we're closing here, that when New Jersey sees how New York has just had to pay $100 million a year for the privilege of passing a law banning fracking, New Jersey's never going to pass that law, and they're going to open themselves up to fracking if that's the case. Dean Baker, really appreciate your walking us through these two issues that are incredibly important for people to understand what's going on with these so-called free trade deals.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Dean Baker is the co-founder and co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. So that was my interview with Dean Baker, and now an interview with Jacob Hacker, who has written a piece in the American Prospect with Paul Pearson on the extremism that has rewarded the Republican Party. Again, reminder, we'll be back live tomorrow, Tuesday. Here's Jacob Hacker. Welcome back to Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar. In the 2014 midterm elections, many Republican candidates hoped to publicly distance themselves from the far-right fringe that had taken over the party by claiming to be more moderate than people like Louie Gohmert or Marco Rubio. But the truth is, there are no moderates left in the Republican Party. There's only a difference between how they deliver their message. Joining me now to explain this and why there hasn't been any type of accountability for their rightward shift is Dr. Jacob Hacker, professor of political science at Yale University. So, Jacob, I was just telling you before the interview that I'm very glad you wrote this piece, because I think that particularly in, it seems to me, in academic and in pundit circles and in the commentariat, there is this belief that Republicans are just about to pay or have paid in some fashion for their extremism. And you make it quite clear in this piece that they have paid no cost for extremism. And I think it's quite clear that they have reaped a lot of benefits from their extremism. But let's start with the three 2014 Senate victors that you say are touted as the Republicans sort of coming to their senses and the establishment candidate has won. And in fact, it really is that the establishment has bent to the extremists.
Yeah, so I think it's really important that people understand this, that there was a fight within the Republican Party, but it wasn't really a fight about ideology. It was a fight about campaign strategy and tactics. And so one of the arguments that my co-author Paul Pearson and I are making is that, you know, the Republican Party continues to move very sharply to the right, even though, you know, the middle of the road American voter doesn't. So we wanted to show that vividly by just taking, you know, three of the examples that the media often trot out for the case that the Republicans have moderated. So the three are Tom Tillis, Joni Ernst, and Tom Cotton. And those who listen to the show probably know that these are not really moderates, but all of them were backed by the Chamber of Commerce. All of them have been touted as evidence that the Republicans aren't going to support crazy Tea Partiers anymore, but each of them is extreme. So Tillis is from, you know, North Carolina, which is at the presidential level actually a contested state, and he has been a big player in the rightward turn of GOP politics within North Carolina. He works with multimillionaire Art Pope, who's an arch-conservative who's in the Koch brothers' inner circle. He sits on the national board of directors of ALEC, and in 2011, ALEC selected him as its legislator of the year, suggesting a great deal of independence. So now Joni Ernst, you know, we all remember her for her, you know, her rather alarming campaign commercials describing that she had grown up castrating pigs and now she was coming to Washington to deal with the pork in Washington. That plain folks demeanor belies an incredible record of extremist policy positions. I mean, she's called for abolishing the Department of Education, the Internal Revenue Service, the Environmental Protection Agency. She says that she'd allow Iowa officials to nullify the Affordable Care Act and arrest federal officials who tried to enforce it. So, you know, again, not a real moderate. Perhaps supported by the big money and like the Chamber of Commerce, but clearly way to the right of most Americans. And then finally, Tom Cotton, who comes from Arkansas, he has a pretty impressive record of talking about welfare and food stamps as being something that's received by you know, really well-off people. He said about food stamp recipients that they have a steak in their basket and they have a brand new iPhone and they have a brand new SUV when he was in the House. And he actually was one of the Republicans who was most in support of using the debt ceiling crisis to force President Obama's hands on the budget. And one of the things that he said he wants to do is voucherize Medicare and raise the Social Security retirement age. So he's also way to the right of not just most Americans, but probably of the middle of the Republican Party as far as that party has gone to the right. So the point is just that the Republicans are still moving right, and that poses, I think, a real challenge, but also a real puzzle. I mean, the challenge is, of course, how do you get Republicans to be more accountable for these positions they've taken, particularly given that, you know, a lot of them come from pretty safe seats, and we've seen that, you know, the House is very well insulated from electoral wins. But the puzzle is, you know, what's driving this, if not ordinary voters?
Let me just stop you. I just want to make one more point and add to that notion of this battle being over. I mean, I've always considered the Tea Party and the establishment, to the extent that there's any difference, these are basically two different companies in the same industry. And really, it seems to me that I think that that the election of these three bears out is that it really is a question of media training for a lot of these. Because like you say, Joni Ernst was saying all sorts of stuff that would have bounced her out of a race years ago. But she was savvy about not saying it during her election. And, you know, Tom Tillis as a perfect example. This is a guy who's against immigration. The Chamber of Commerce, one of their primary issues is immigration reform. They still backed him. So to the extent that there was ever a war of ideology or positions, it seems the far right has won, and the establishment has just media trained these people to go forward.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, my sense is that the Chamber does want the Republicans to behave a little bit more responsibly, but that its main concern is that they stay supportive of the larger economic policy positions that the Chamber has, and that's certainly true of all these folks. But I mean, I think there's a deeper issue here, which is that, you know, we've seen now a series of elections where Republicans have lost at the presidential level or faced big pressure at the congressional level because of the position they've taken, like on the debt ceiling crisis or the budget shutdowns. But the fact is the party does not moderate after these events, and they've mostly gotten away with it. You know, they've managed to gain control of both the House and the Senate. They've got a lot more state houses than they did before. And I think for most people, you know, the obvious answer to why this is, it must be that they're doing what voters want. And the fact is when you start to look at where voters are on the issue, that's just not the case. And so it's worth thinking about how this is happening. It's worth thinking about both because it'll help us understand better what's really driving American politics today, if not the typical voter. And I think it's useful because it'll help you understand how you might push back and get some more moderation in American politics.
All right, well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about this notion of the median voter, I don't know if a median voter still exists in this country or had ever existed, but it certainly dictates the analysis that we see from the mainstream in many respects. And then from the median voter, we'll go on to talk about why the Republicans are able to operate not only with no accountability, but almost to their credit when they act in a way that is really misaligned from the way that most Americans would want them to act, or I guess legislate. We got to take a break. We'll be right back with more. We're back on Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking with Yale University political science professor Dr. Jacob Hacker about the rightward shift of the Republican Party and how the GOP seems to have no accountability for their extremism. So, Jacob, before the break, we had gone over this idea that there was really any type of battle, ideological battle, between the so-called establishment and the Tea Party or the far right of the party, that in many respects they're one and the same. And so the question then becomes, why are the Republicans, if they are not actually holding positions that the average American holds, why does it seem like they are, at least in terms of the lack of accountability?
Well, I think there's a really important thing to understand, and that is that our political system makes it pretty hard to hold politicians accountable, right? The clearest place where we can hold politicians accountable is at the presidential election level, and that's where the most people vote and where there's the most attention on the record of the incumbent, and it's revealing that Democrats have had a pretty sharp edge at the presidential level in the last couple of presidential elections, suggesting that, you know, the Republican brand really isn't very strong when you get to the elections where the most attention is paid to the records of the candidates. But when you start to look beneath the presidential level, you start to see a whole lot of reasons why it's hard to hold politicians accountable in American politics, right? Not that many people turn out to vote. The electorates that turn out to vote in elections are also skewed towards Republicans because the overall map for the House is heavily weighted towards the GOP. Why? Because urban areas vote overwhelmingly Democratic, and also there's been gerrymandering, and so there's lots of districts that are overwhelmingly Democratic and lots of wasted votes, if you will, for the Democrats and Republicans able to pick up more seats as a result. So those are some of the reasons why you shouldn't assume that this reflects what the electorate wants. But I think most commentators sort of start with the assumption that a big part of this must be that both parties are kind of running away from the center. We're so polarized, and therefore that voters just don't have a choice, and they kind of pinch their nose and vote for Republicans or Democrats, both of which are extreme relative to their positions. But the point that Paul Pearson and I make in our piece is that there is no evidence for that. In fact, it's very clear the Republicans have moved a lot farther right than the Democrats have moved left, and that makes it even more puzzling that they haven't faced a big accountability moment, as George W. Bush once called it. So we think there are a couple of reasons why this has happened. One, just mentioned, is that it's hard in our system, that turnout isn't high enough in a lot of races, that there's an edge for Republicans. But the other reason that I think people pay less attention to is that Republicans have kind of figured out how to crack the code of this system that makes accountability so hard, because they've basically learned how to tie up American government and do things that make people hate government. In ways that actually work to their benefit, right? It makes it hard to hold them accountable because everything is a mess. You know, Mitch McConnell, when Obama was trying to push through initiatives right after he was elected, basically said, let's not support anything, because if we support anything, people will think it's bipartisan, it's good. And by adopting that, scorched earth strategy of blocking everything, fighting everything, making everything into a huge mess, Republicans really helped to sour voters on politics and on government and help themselves in the 2010 midterm elections. So that's I think, the really important lesson of what Republicans have done, that voters have a hard time figuring out what exactly is going on in our complicated and gridlocked political system. And the anti-government party, the Republican Party, benefits when they think everything is a mess. And Republicans have basically figured out that this is a winning formula. It doesn't work as well at the presidential level, but it works really well at the House and Senate level. And, Republicans have found themselves able to kind of enact or carry out the perfect political crime, which is they've made American politics, really crippled, but they've not paid for the price for that at the polls.
And to a certain extent, it's not just a matter of, the shark story that you tell.
Yeah.
That story, because if people want to know why we heard so much about Ebola in the weeks running up to the election, this is really why, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, look, there was a great study that was done by a political scientist at Princeton, Larry Bartels, which showed that that Woodrow Wilson in 1916 had a lower presidential vote on the New Jersey shore because there had been a series of shark attacks at the time. In fact, these shark attacks became the basis for the movie Jaws 70 years later. And of course, Woodrow Wilson does not have control over shark attacks, but it really shows you that voters tend to respond to negative events, poor economic outcomes, momentary crises like the Ebola outbreak, with a very anti-incumbent bias. And so, one of the parts of the strategy that that has proved to be really helpful in terms of and limiting accountability is that Republicans have found a way, a very effective way, to kind of flood the airwaves with scandals, usually ginned up right before an election. So we heard 6 weeks of wall-to-wall coverage about Ebola that disappeared, the moment after the election. And as President Obama at the correspondents' dinner this year joked, or rather he had his anger translator Luther joke that, you know what, nobody has Ebola. So that. That crisis disappeared. It was the same in the 2010 midterm elections with the crisis mongering around the economy and the claims that about President Obama's destroying it. And, so trying to create this kind of really strong negative backlash against government has proved really successful, Republicans. And they do it through various strategies. But the point is that voters don't naturally punish the politicians who are responsible for dysfunction. They often punish the wrong guy, and that's in part because it's pretty hard to pin the blame on the party and that causes the problem. I was going to say pin the blame on the donkey, which is what Republicans want. But it's pretty hard to pin the blame on the elephant because it's so complicated and messy, and because Republicans do such a good job when they're unified, holding things up without making it clear who's at fault.
In terms of those off-year elections, talk about the difference in the Republican and the Democratic base.
Yeah, so this is important. I mean, one of the ways in which the parties are not the same, are not symmetrical, is that the Republican base is just a lot bigger, badder, and more powerful than the Democratic base. It kind of does the Republican base a disservice to compare it to the Democratic base. It's much, much more unified. It believes that it's fighting a kind of like a real war for the future of the country. You know, the Democratic Party is better understood as having a lot of sort of group-based commitments, but often not that kind of same philosophical fervor. And, you know, the Republicans have mobilized that base over the last 25 years, but especially the last 5 to 10 years. You know, a big part of it is Fox News and conservative talk radio, which, again, has no counterpart on the other side of the aisle. And you see it in polls that show that, first, there are about twice as many base conservative voters as base progressive or liberal voters, and second of all, that those base conservative voters are much less willing to compromise, much more likely to see President Obama or other Democrats as being kind of the enemy, and much more likely to shift from trusting to distrusting the federal government when there is a Democrat in the Oval Office. In fact, right now, you know, with levels of trust as low as they are, Republicans are basically at a level where their trust in the federal government, you know, is in the low single digits. And that kind of corrosiveness of distrust and that anger and that mobilization is just very important to understanding why the Republican Party still sees it as good strategy to run to the right. And so you have to understand why the Republican base has basically pulled the Republicans to the right, and the Republicans have been able to get away with being that far to the right because of all those problems of accountability that I already talked about. Basically, they figured out how to have their extremist cake and eat it too.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And, you know, the solution is certainly not a silver bullet, and it's not going to happen anytime soon. And folks are going to have to head over to the American Prospect to see your piece, No Cost for Extremism. Dr. Jacob Hacker, thank you so much for your time today. Genuinely appreciate it.
No, thanks for having me on, Sam.
Dr. Jacob Hacker is the director of the Institution for Social and Policy Studies and Stanley B. Reeser Professor of Political Science at Yale University.
Say to Napoleon.